Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's show, veteran sportscaster and collegiate linebacker Fred Khalil reflects on 42 years of covering major sports and also overcoming a major health setback. And also,
boy, victory smells so sweet when you win some case that you're working on, facing death in some cases. It makes you have the itch to keep going. But when you're doing something to help a whole lot of people, it feels really, really good.
Zernona Clayton talks about the journey as a journalist and civil rights activist. Some important conversations, wonderful conversations coming up ahead. But first, from our WAB newsroom, after changes in the Georgia House, Senate Bill 140 is being debated as we speak by lawmakers. The controversial measure would ban most medical treatments that help transgender kids affirm their gender identity. The Republican-led legislation prohibits doctors from providing hormone replacement therapy and gender-confirming surgery for minors. Democratic Senator Nan Arok addressed the chamber.
So the stakes are high here. This isn't just about another bill that we're going to take a look at and then we're going to cast our vote. The stakes are high. You are impacting real families, real people, real children. You're also impacting negatively the healthcare community that provides services, needed services for transgendered youth.
And there'll be more on Senate Bill 140 later today from WABE News. And a programming note tomorrow on Closer Look, a conversation with faith leaders for and in opposition of Senate Bill 140. In other news, it's election day for some metro voters in Clayton County. There are five candidates running to permanently replace former Sheriff Victor Hill. He was sentenced last week to a year and a half in federal prison for violating the civil rights of some detainees. Also on the ballot is a five-year extension of Clayton County's 1% education sales tax and a special election to replace State Representative Mike Glanton, who resigned for health reasons. Over in Fayette County, a six-year extension of the 1% sales tax is on their ballot, and residents in the new city of Mapleton will be voting for mayor and city council. You're listening to Closer Look. We're back in a moment.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
And Closer Look continues from WABE here in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. His name is Fred Khalil. He's been covering sports for a long time, 42 years in the business, 31 years of covering local sports, and he has covered it all from countless championships, several Super Bowls, World Series games, and of course the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta. He's a Hall of Famer in the Atlanta Press Club. There is a connection here that he doesn't know yet, but I'm going to tell him. We just wanted to say before he bids farewell as a member of the Atlanta News First Team to welcome Fred Khalil.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I'm honored that you would ask me to come on.
See what happens when you retire. It only takes 42 years, Fred.
That's all it does, man. That's it. You know, and you're back, and here we go.
Let's get to what this I call the 6 degrees of separation.
Okay.
Now, I went to Indiana State. You were in Indiana.
Right.
And you left Wish TV to come to
Atlanta.
In what year?
1992.
I was an intern at Wish TV. I started in the summer of 92.
Wow. So I missed you by a month.
By a month. I worked with Dick Ray and Mark Patrick and I think Tina Crosby.
No, Tina Crosby. Yeah.
Yeah. Dick
Ray. Tina.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love Tina.
And I think you left some mugs there.
I did. I better go get them then. Huh? My IU. I wonder what happened to my IU mug, right? My Indiana mug.
IU. I used to go to IU for Lil' Five.
I bet you did.
That's all I can say, Fred. I can't tell anymore.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't. And that weekend, yeah, just that's in the vault.
Yeah, but Bloomington is a beautiful place in the fall, I tell you.
It is. It's a great campus. You know, Breaking Away, the movie of, God, it's been like 40 years ago now, it seems like. Yeah. But that movie was a great movie. It was filmed on campus, actually. You know, they came out to spring football practice.
Yeah. Wow.
And so, you know, we were, if you can slow it down and stop it, you can see a couple of us and you know, and hear our voices and stuff, you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
You know, I think for when we're all starting out as journalists and you think, oh my goodness, I have to start out in a small market. But I got to tell you, if you're covering sports in Anderson, Indiana, that's a really good, you've been to the Wigwam.
The Wigwam. You better believe it. Yeah.
And tell the folks what the Wigwam's all about.
The Wigwam is a big, well, it's for Indiana, it's average sized arena for high school basketball. What's it hold, about 8,000 or 9,000,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they play on Wednesday nights. And if you get Anderson and Anderson-Madison Heights playing in there,
yes,
on a Wednesday night, it'll be sold out. You'll have 9,000 people in there.
Packed.
It'll be probably live on television,
yeah,
right? And it's a great place to watch high school basketball. I mean, it's what high school basketball. And the thing is, people may not realize that the Wigwam, you got the Wigwam, you've got Carmel that holds about 6,500 mm-hmm. or 7,000, right?
Yeah.
You've got Southport High School that holds about 9,000.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, these are all high school gyms.
Yeah.
Okay. Muncie Central.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got Anderson and Muncie right there side by side. So those are big rivalry games as well. And you've got the Muncie, I don't know what the, not the Civic Center, but the big arena there. And so you've got arenas in every, not major town, but semi-major town that is bigger than the population of the city.
Absolutely.
Like Ligoti, Indiana has an arena. They used to have a field house that would seat, I think, 7,000, and there were only 6,000 people in the town.
I saw Damon Bailey play in high school, and it was just, it was
crazy.
Crazy. That's
played
that's,
at the Hoosier Dome, like 41,000 people at the Hoosier Dome to see Bedford North Lawrence win the state championship.
You ever been yelled at by Bobby Knight? Because I have.
I have.
Isn't that a great feeling? I feel like you've
it is
you've
really
reached
not.
It.
It's not, no, because I've been yelled at more than once by him.
When you go back to the first market, what market did you start out in?
Well, I was in Indianapolis in college.
Yeah.
At Channel 4, which was an independent station. And it was on, I did football games with a guy by the name of Jerry Baker. So I did football games on the IU and what is now the Big Ten Network.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was broadcast all over the Midwest. And as I was doing those games, the guy that was supposed to do anchor sports that night didn't show up. And so they said, hey, man, you want to anchor sports. That's what you told me. I said, yeah. Well, you can do it tonight. I'm going, what? So we get off the airplane. We're coming back from a game. Got off the airplane. I drove in there. Didn't know how to edit. Didn't know how to do anything. And they said, you've got 8.5 minutes for sports.
Which is a long time.
That's a long time. That's considered that now we get a minute and a half.
Yeah.
So
wow.
7 more minutes than that. And it's just, and with no feeds or anything. So you've got to generate your own.
Mm-hmm.
Content and find the video and
make sure the graphic fits.
And I didn't know how to do graphics. I didn't know how to do video. I mean, I don't know how to edit. I was just kind of slapping it together and somehow made it. But that led to my first real job after graduation because it was Huntington, West Virginia, which I think at the time was, I don't know, kids, when we were that age, we always worried about market size.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 41. And they said, hey, look, you know, we want to see another tape. You know, we like what we see. We want to see another tape. I go, well, I'll do you one better. I said, I don't have time to put together another tape, but we're cabled into your market.
Yeah.
I said, so you can watch me live.
Wow.
And it's that helped me get the job.
And when you think back to working in those smaller markets, Fred, and how you are now, your approach, all of that was so helpful. We might have hated working in, I don't know about hate it, but, you know, you start a small market, well, but it helps.
It's kind of back to the future, really, because we're back doing what we did, you know, because there's less. You have to do more with less now. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I still edit videotape. I still do everything I did in Huntington, you know, pretty much. You know, in Huntington, it's so funny. You know, the supers that they put in, like if you see Fred Khalil across the thing. So we have to put that in now. You know, we do all that. And in Huntington, we had a guy that did that. And he said, hey, you want me to giz you? I said, what? He goes, you want me to giz you? I said, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, you want your name on the TV screen underneath your face? I said, yeah. I said, what'd you call it? He goes, well, I got to type it in the gizmo. So we just call it giz. So it was like, you know, if you saw like anything on the bottom of the screen that was written, it was typed in the gizmo. So it was giz. Giz that. Yeah. Hey, giz Huntington. Okay. Yeah, give me a giz Marshall.
When I was an intern at Wish and I was on the teleprompter, and I remember Debbie Knox yelling, because, you know, you have to, folks, when you're running the teleprompter, you have to run it at the pace of the anchor.
And these were paper scripts that were, yes, you had to feed
paper,
in there now.
Feed.
It's all computer now, and everybody runs their own prompter, but you had to do it, and you had to do it with paper. So you had to feed the script into the, and then
turn a knob yeah.
And make it go through there. So your job is much harder than what you're saying. So go ahead.
And I remember she said, who's on the teleprompter? Must be an intern.
Well, who do you think it is, Debbie? I mean, you know.
Wow. When you came to Atlanta, did you figure this is going to be it? This is where I'm probably going to spend a great deal of my career.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
But somebody said when they hired me, they go, you know what? They don't hire people at Gannett to get rid of them. And that's who owned Channel 11.
Yeah.
Excuse me. So, you know, I was fortunate enough. They did a big campaign when I got here, mm-hmm, in 1992, a huge campaign called Check Out Fred. And it was, they had, and they continued it too. So this was years ago, 1992. So they had a box with a videotape of me in it, of my resume reel, in the, to introduce me to Atlanta. And it was a free checkout at any Blockbuster store.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it was Check Out Fred. And they had Check Out Fred everywhere. They had Check Out Fred stickers. They had Check Out Fred t-shirts. I checked out Fred, you know, and they had a song with it. I mean, it was crazy.
That's unbelievable. That's
it. Wild. Was crazy. It really was. And they got a Dennis. If you remember in the 90s, Dion played both, mm-hmm, baseball and football for the Braves. And there was a comedian at the time and an actor, Dennis Leary. Mm-hmm. Okay. And he did a Nike spot with Dion. You know, I think you hear me knocking. And I'm coming in, and I'm bringing Dion and his big, bad bass, whatever it was, yeah, with me. So they got a Dennis Leary lookalike, and they had me stand behind him with my arms folded. And then he'd knock, you know. And he goes, I think you hear me knocking, and I'm coming in, and I'm bringing Fred and his big, bad sports cast with me. So that was...
Wow.
That was incredible.
Is it tough? Or what's the process like so that the teams, you know, here's the new sportscaster, new person. What's that process like getting them to know and trust you where you can get a scoop? Or, you know, yeah, they've had a bad game. Somebody goes 0-for-4. You know, you've got Chipper, you know. Is there a process in getting them to feel comfortable with you?
Well, you know, you don't light them up for no reason.
Yeah, well,
you know, and if you shouldn't. And if you say something, like I think it was one time – God, I forget the defensive back, but I did light him up on the Falcons, and I went out there, and he started yelling at me, and I said, yeah, what do you want? I mean, you got torched. What do you want me to say? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, tell me what you want me to say, and I'll say it. You know, explain it.
Yeah.
I went to talk to you. You didn't want to talk to me. So if you won't talk to me to explain yourself,
yeah,
and I just have to go by what I see, you know, and you got lit up.
Yeah.
So – that's how it goes. And, you know, and really I think most players respect that. If you come to practice and you show your face, mm-hmm, they'll respect that.
And you're fair.
Try to be,
yeah.
Always, yeah.
The Olympics, 96, summer I moved here. It was just incredible. Is that of all the sporting events that you've covered, is that the pinnacle for you in terms of just the environment, you know, everything around it?
The time of my life, because we were at the NBC station. Mm-hmm. So the Olympics were on our station, mm-hmm, and we hosted every show in and out of the Olympics. So it couldn't get any better. You know, it was great. You know, and all the different you know, stars that would come through. They'd all come on the show with you, and everything was relaxed, and it was great. And, you know, we just had a good time. I mean, I can remember it was a country star. I forget his name. I think John Berry, because he's from here.
Oh.
And he had a big hit at the time. And he came on, he sat with us, and, "Hey, Fred, how you doing?" I said, "Hey, what's going on?" Because he lived here. And I said, "Hey, John, nice to see you." And he sat on, and he goes, "Yeah, we're going to do a song." I said, "Okay, go ahead." You know, and he just sang live. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, that was pretty neat. We had a good time.
What did you, when you saw Muhammad Ali, because you were down there.
Oh, it was crazy.
What did you make of that?
Yeah. It was nuts. I was in tears. It was.
I know.
That was an unreal moment. Mm-hmm. It was the moment of a lifetime, really. I mean, to get him there and, you know, for Billy Payne and all those guys, Andrew Young, everybody to keep that secret because nobody knew.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't think, because the place went wild. I mean, every guy in that stadium went crazy.
It was nuts. Something. It was something. Fred, you have covered so much, been awarded. You've got the awards that's, and well-deserved. And then you have a major medical setback and the pouring of support for you.
It was great.
How did that help you?
It was great. It really was, you know. You always find out who your friends are. Mm-hmm. And I found out I had a lot of friends.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I had people that I didn't know mm-hmm. call me. And somebody said, "Why do you talk to all those people?" I go, "Why wouldn't I?" I mean, they're reaching out. They're trying to be nice. They would really want to know how you're doing.
Did you think about retiring?
No. Mm-hmm. Then?
Yeah.
No. No, I wouldn't. My coach in college is Lee Corso, okay, mm-hmm. the guy that's on ESPN. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and he called me up and he said, "Hey, you better get your ass in rehab. You better get going. He said, you better not quit." I said, "Okay." You know, so I worked hard in physical rehab, physical therapy, speech therapy, memory therapy, and we just worked, and I had great therapists, and they just worked and worked and worked with me and were patient with me, and thankfully, you know, I came out on the other side.
Yeah, we are. We're all thankful for that. When you think back to that linebacker that walked on at IU.
And got carried off.
And now you're about to be a grandfather, I understand,
right.
For the first time? Yeah.
It's crazy. It's crazy. Time flies.
What do you tell that grandkid when he's old enough to talk and say, I don't even want to call you Papa or, you know.
I don't know
grandpa.
Either yet. We don't know yet. We haven't decided. But
says, what did you do in life?
What did I do in life?
What are you going to tell him?
I tried to be a good friend, tried to be a good husband, tried to be a good dad, just tried to be a good guy, you know.
Yeah.
Just try to. You're the best person you can be.
I remember watching a friend of mine. I won't mention his name because I don't want people to give him a lot of stuff. But a friend of mine made it to ESPN. And the first thing he said was, "Oh, my ego has landed," because ESPN was that. That you want to get to. And when you look at sportscasters now, and sometimes it's a little bit of theater. And sometimes it's about the personality and less about giving information to the. I always approach it because my career began in sports is the listener, the viewer knows nothing about it. So I don't want to come across as being a know-it-all, but I want to tell the game.
Sure.
You know, and not make it about me. You look at where we are now in this industry. What do you like? What do you don't like?
Oh, you know, I mean, it's always been about personality. What they're doing on ESPN now is what we used to do in local TV when we had time. When we'd get like 3.5-4 minutes, that's what we would do. Because... See, I would argue that people just don't want to sit there and be read the scores or here's what,
True.
They want to have a little personality. They want to have a connection with that. Yeah, that's my guy. That's my neighbor. Or that's, you know, yeah, I know that guy. Yeah, you're that guy, you know. Hey, I know you. I see you. You know, so that's, you know, that's really how I approached it. I just tried to be, you know, the guy next door telling you what's going on.
I have a listener who says, "I love Fred Khalil and I'll miss him."
That's nice. That really is nice.
Yeah.
I'll miss everybody too, because I mean, this is something I love. And I, you know, when you do something, well, 1979, so what's that, 44 years? Mm. You do something that long, I mean, that's a long time.
Why now, Fred, is the time to...
Well, you know what? It's just, you know, I'm at the age where there's not much more I can do. Local news, you know, I don't think plays the role that it once did, you know, mm-hmm. where you were the connection to the people, you know, you were the high schools. And really, that's the only local connection now is really high school sports because, mm-hmm. let's face it, you can go online right now and I can get anything that we're going to do in sports, I can get it before we do it. I hate to say that, but,
yeah.
you know, if you really want it that bad. And there aren't that many people that really want it that bad. That's the key. You know, there just aren't that many people that really want it that bad. If you look at local news viewership today, it just gets less and less mm-hmm. because people can get it on their phone or they can, you know, get it online and just watch it whenever they want to watch it yeah. on demand. You know, there's no waiting up till 11 o'clock. Oh, I want to see what Fred's got to say.
Yeah, because we used to have to do that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that doesn't happen anymore. So
what's the next chapter for Fred Khalil like?
The next chapter, I don't know. You know, I really don't know. It's kind of an unwritten chapter, so I really don't know what's going to happen. I hope that I can have some fun, enjoy life, you know, have some weekends off. Yeah. You know, hang out on Friday night. What's that going to be like, hanging out on Friday night and Saturday night, back to back? A Friday night and Saturday night, back to back. I might be in jail.
What is it? Uh-oh.
Uh-oh, look out.
I got you, Fred. I got money on the bail.
Okay, good.
Fred Khalil, thank you so much for being the gold standard in this business.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for saying that.
Honored to follow you without even knowing I was following you. But
that's right. At Wish TV News 8.
See Atlanta. See what came out of Wish TV. Fred Khalil and little old Rose Scott.
That's it. All right, Rose.
Best of luck to you, Fred. I appreciate it.
Thank you, hon. Appreciate it.
All right, brother.
Okay. You got it.
Doing a closer look, we're upstairs in Studio 4 where I don't have to put on makeup or heels, but today is special because we have a special edition of Closer Look, and I'm joined now by pioneering broadcaster, civil rights activist, actress, author, entrepreneur, Ms. Zernona Clayton.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. That sounds so impressive.
It does sound impressive. Can you take me back? I want to begin here because I remember the first interview I ever did, and I was nervous. Do you remember your very first interview you did and what it was about, and were you nervous?
I remember it, and no, I wasn't nervous. Well, the funniest thing about it, I'd been in a studio, and I've seen other them, and they always put your name down on the floor with a crayon. You know, big. And so I was saying, they kept saying we're ready. I said, no, where's my name? and so, what do you mean? You know how everybody, because I'd been a guest, you know, that's what they did with everybody, write the names down. So I said, put my name down. Oh, and they did. I never looked at it.
you were born in Muskogee, Oklahoma.
Yes.
In 19,
yeah. Good.
How does a young girl from Muskogee, Oklahoma, get to where she is now? What's that journey been like for you?
Well, the story dropped me in a blessed home. Mm-hmm. My mother and father happened to have been wonderful, wonderful parents. And they got together, I think, on who does what. My mother reprimanded us. My dad gave us the lectures from the whippings we had gotten. And so the two of them teamed up to make whatever you did look pretty bad. But my mother left a lasting impression on me, which I still live by today. My sister and I were kind of spoiled because although they loved us and reprimanded us, we didn't have it just that simply easy. Mm-hmm. We had guests one evening for dinner, and we had a lot of dishes in the kitchen. And we didn't have dishwashers in those early days. So my mother asked us to clean the kitchen because she was tired. Well, we took a look at that kitchen and said, oh, golly, that's a job. And so we figured, oh, she's going to forget it. We kept visiting with her and visited with her. And finally she went to bed. We said, oh, good. She won't remember that she asked us to do the dishes. And by morning, we'd be gone to school, and she'll have to wash the dishes. Well, she was waiting for us when we came home from school. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, you didn't do what I told you, so now you're going to get punished for it. Well, we thought she was pretty harsh with the punishment, but the lesson learned still lives with me today. She said, there's a price you pay for the life you live. She said, now, had you washed the dishes, we wouldn't have been at this point. You know, you wouldn't be getting a whipping now. Mm. But you violated the rule. And so as the years go and you've grown and you learn by more experiences, that lesson will stick with you. You live the life, you pay for the life you live.
You've had a lot of folks that were influential in your life, and I know you've heard a lot of wisdom, and you've heard a lot of, I guess, messaging that has stayed with you. So from your parents and to the outer circle of your family, who else has been the most influential for you?
I think the list is too long, because somehow almost every place I went, in every environment I visited, I learned something. Mm-hmm. I'm very observant, so I'll see how people behave, how people talk, how people act. And so I've learned lessons from so many sources, you know. But being kind to people was the one that just will fit in a setting. And to this day, I don't think I could be harsh. Well, maybe I can. But I'm not nasty to people.
No, you're not.
You know, I can't be, you know. You don't have to be, really.
Mm-hmm. And I can attest to that, because I interviewed you years ago for the Trumpet Award. But for y'all to know, I interviewed Miss Clayton, and then I got a call from someone in her camp that said, Miss Clayton would like for you to work the Trumpet Awards red carpet. And you called, it was on a Friday, and the awards were that Saturday, uh-huh. Which meant I had to get a gown and get in heels and put on makeup.
Yes.
I had none of that. Mm-hmm. So I called friends, and they all got me together. And another friend told me, Carmen Burns, who you know, who's also a mentor, said, when Miss Clayton calls, you answer, you mm-hmm. do it. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that from a lot of people, from Ted Turner, from Shirley Franklin, from Valerie Jackson, from so every mayor. What does that say to you about what you have meant to so many people?
I have an inner sense that says excellence is my way. It's got to be right. I'm going to do it right, and I expect you to do the same. And people who didn't want to do what I instructed them to do, I just got rid of them. They said, how you fire volunteers? I said, easily. They said, but they're giving their time. I said, I don't want anybody to give me something I can't use. I can't use slothfulness, and I can't use defiance. Mm-hmm. You know, just do it. Do it the right way. We'll have no problem.
I must have did it the right way, because I survived 6 hours in heels. I want you to know, Ms. Clayton, but for you, I did that. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Trumpet Awards, because you had a vision. And I was told once that, you know, you can't say no to Nona Clayton. And if you do say no, she's going to come back and ask you again. What was the journey like getting the Trumpet Awards to where it is now?
Well, one thing, someone had given me advice who had worked for Ted much longer than I had. And they said, now, if you go to him with some request, be sure you can back it up with a lot of answers, because he will ask 100 questions. I stayed up all night trying to write out every question I thought he could possibly ask me when I knew I was going to ask him that day. Because the way I wanted to do the Trumpet Awards was going to cost money. I knew that. I didn't know how much, but I knew it was going to be more costly than anything else we were doing. And I let him know that these are the people I'm reaching for. My objective was to start now telling the story of Black survival, mm-hmm. Black contributions, Black presence in our society. Dr. King said that he didn't believe that all white people hated us because they loved to hate. Mm-hmm. He said, I think that if they knew who we really were, there would be less hatred. So we got to tell the story of black success, black contributors. And so that's what I was doing to try to let the nation, the world, because I didn't know we were going to be picked up by, you know, international television network. But I wanted people to hear what we had to say, not just look at our color. And if you look today, I think about it all the time, because everybody has to encounter a traffic light somewhere in their lives every day, sometimes painful too. Yes. But how many people would know that a black person created the trumpet award, I mean, the trumpet award, the traffic light? We can't get along without it. So that's a major contribution. And there were many, many, many stories beyond that. And I said to him, he looked at my list of people I was going to invite for the first. He said, you can get all these people here? I said, oh, yes, every one of them. He didn't believe me. So I said, but you have to stay and attend the awards because it establishes my credibility. If you think it's okay, then they will too. And the first night there, he got all dressed up with tuxedo. And then he kept running to me. Zernona, guess who's here? Muhammad Ali is here. Lena Horne is here. And he was so excited. And I said, yes, I invited him, you know. Well, I was one. I had won over the first night. I was off and running from the very first night.
What has been, and it may seem like a silly question to ask, what's been more rewarding in being able to produce something like the Trumpet Awards or what you, being part of the Civil Rights Movement, being part of Dr. King's inner circle, not just to Dr. King, but to Mrs. King as well. Is it even fair to even ask, you know, what's been the most rewarding?
Yeah, because it's hard to do that. Because you're not making comparisons when you help on one of them or somebody like them. You're there to deliver the services they need. So you're not making a comparative study. You just do what will make their performance better and improved. And so each person stands on his own merit. So I didn't make comparisons. But I did the service that they needed. And everybody, you know, would brag about the fact that I do good service.
I will never forget the story that you tell of driving Dr. King to the airport as he's about to leave for Memphis and the conversation that you had with his mother to have with him about spending more time. I think about that at this time of year as we get closer to April 4th. Your time with the Kings is immeasurable in terms of what you've been able to still do in honor of them and because you were part of what the mission was. Is there anything about Dr. King or Mrs. King that folks still just don't know or just get about this couple?
Well, boy, you've done a lot of research.
Well, I have to, Zenon. I'm talking to you.
What was interesting about the two of them, you know, it was the first time I'd really kind of done service for a husband and wife because, you know, you think of some secrets you'd like to share. And you find these are husband and wife, you know. And so it was a little challenging. But I just threw it out the window that this is not Martin Luther King's wife. This is my friend, someone who's accompanying her. See, I accompanied her on concert tours. And we were together on one tour, 10 nights, and days and nights. And so she even said as we were headed for home, she said, you know, this is the first time I spent 10 days and nights with a woman because somehow something happens with women. We will fall out before 10 days are up. But we never did. But my job was not to fight with her. My job was to help her. And I did that. But she was such a nice person. She was sweet and kind and thoughtful. And we got along like girlfriends, you know, like I'd met her over the years. And that was the first time, the first concert we went on was the first time I'd really met her. And we got along famously, and she cited that as we were, you know, coming home for the last time on this tour to say we slept together, ate together for 10 days and 10 nights and never fell out, you know.
Mm-hmm. When you see the work that Bernice King is doing and Martin III, and you've watched these kids grow up, and sadly Yolanda has passed on and then Dexter, but do you also just still see them as the little kids running around the house?
Well, I kind of remember some moments. I took them all out. I had never done that, to take four kids, and they had a friend. So we really had eight kids that I took to Fun Time. What's the roller coaster?
Six Flags?
Yeah, Six Flags. But so there were different stages and ages. So, you know, they had to do different things. And I gave them the law. I said, now listen, those of you who are in this age group, you know, we have to wait for the other group to have the ride, but we can't split up, so you have to be patient and wait. Now, if you don't, I'm going to take you to the car. And it was hot, hot, hot day. And Bernice kind of broke ranks, but she was the youngest. It really probably wasn't fair to take her on this because she was the youngest and the older one, you know, 4 years old. The other a little older, but she got a little impatient, and then I said, oh, golly, what am I going to do? I can't take her to the car and leave. It was hot, hot, hot.
And that's against the law. And that's against the law.
Oh, I didn't know that, but but I had to kind of stay in control. Mm-hmm. I was the only adult. And so I said to them, well, Bernice and I has violated some of our rules, so I got to take her to the car. And I was wondering, what am I going to do once I get to the car? Well, it was so hot. Even when I opened the door, you could feel the heat coming out of the car. But I made a believer out of her. Obviously, I wasn't going to leave her. Mm-hmm. But she thought I was going to. And leave her in the car by herself. And I just counseled her while I had her in the car, that hot car. But she understood very clearly then that I was there to service, you know, these different age levels, and everybody had to cooperate. And she was no trouble after that. But what I didn't know is Mrs. King had stayed home. She was going to run errands, but she said, I think she's going to bring Bernice home early, you know, because she was the only one who was, you know, her age. But that was the only time she acted up. But after that, when I made a believer of her that I'll take her to the car, she was fine and stayed in tune with the others, you know.
I'm going to tell her that story when I see her. The civil rights movement, and I know you have been asked this question in terms of when you think of the civil rights movement, the approach that you all have, you think of this generation of young activists, and while there are some parallels, there's often some criticism, and people say, oh, they should do it this way, or you should borrow this template from the civil rights movement. And you're often asked to comment and maybe give them advice. But do you feel that's fair? Do you want them to do it their way? Or what can you all still offer, you, Andy, Harry? What do you say to them about
this current? Well, I really don't try to act like the spokesperson of, you know, the problems that we faced. I can tell the story, but you have to feel the need to get involved. You can't tell people, join us. They got to want to. Mm-hmm. You've got to look around and see that the water fountain is a cruel thing to do to people. You got a separate black and a white water fountain. As a matter of fact, the first time I saw it, I thought it was Kool-Aid. You know, I didn't know it was real water, just plain water like everybody else, but one was black and one was white. And maybe they got Kool-Aid in this one, you know. Yeah. But you're not giving counseling. You're trying to talk about the problem. You know, we got a problem here, and all of us are here trying to solve the problem. And once they understand that we're fighting an issue here, got to stay in tune. You got to follow the leader, because as a leader in every phase of the movement, someone is attacking this problem, somebody else is attacking the other, and we got followers to assist. But the inside of you makes you want to know, just because you're black on the outside, mm-hmm, doesn't mean that you know, an ugly person, mm-hmm, or an undesirable person. And so we got to solve the problem. we don't have time to argue. Mm-hmm. And so there's no place for argument. You know, follow the leader. That's what I tell everybody, follow the leader. Every movement has a segment where there's a leader of the group. And so when people don't, but you don't have much of that. People knew we had a serious problem in this country, mm-hmm. and we just had a little phase of it, a little portion of it, a little parcel of it. And boy, victory smells so sweet when you win some case that you're working on, mm-hmm. facing death in some cases. It makes you have the itch to keep going. But when you doing something to help a whole lot of people, it feels really, really good.
How did you, during that time as well, because you were so involved with so much, but you had to take time for yourself. Nowadays, we talk a lot about mental health and taking breaks and people making sure they're okay internally while they do the work externally. I'm curious, Ms. Clayton, how did you, what was your balance for you?
Well, I was more often the caretaker.
Yeah.
Like when people got hurt on the movement somewhere, my job was to take them to the hospital. And let me give you one example where we were in Jackson, Mississippi. I walked into the hospital with some people with me who had been injured. And there was a line of black people already there. You could see they were tired. They'd been waiting a long time. Because they were black, they had to sit on this side of the room, mm-hmm. and the white people sat on the other. And I walked in with my group, and I was saying, oh, gee, I bet you this is a segregated. I didn't even ask because the law didn't allow it, but people practice it, you know, against the law. But I went in with a smile like, miss, I got several people who were injured, and I was very pleasant about it. My pleasant attitude was, I didn't come here to fight. I didn't come here to burn this building down. I came here to get help for these people who are trying to right the wrongs of our society. And my group got waited on before the other people had been waiting there hours and hours. So here I thought, gee whiz, the lady at the desk so made a difference in us. I was dressed. Mm-hmm. The other people, you know, looked like farmers. Because they were from farmlands anyway. And so she made a judgment call, I think. On the outside, I looked like I was okay. Mm-hmm. The others looked like they were tired and maybe going to fight. I don't know what, I didn't ask her what was going through her head. I just theorized that, mm-hmm. that she took me and my group into to get attention, and she left the others out. Then after we were service, and I said to them, come on, you can join my group, you know, mm-hmm. and then got them service. But you have to do that a lot. You just take the bull by the horn, or the horn by the bull, I don't know which it is, but just be willing to do whatever's necessary if you're confronted with violence.
But how did you deal with, I'm sure there were times when you were exhausted, you were tired. When did you know to take a break? Did you take a break?
Well, you don't think about it. I went to a school with Dr. King, and they had the students behind ropes, you know, kind of like as a barrier. So when he came out, he would wave at them, but they couldn't get to him. Well, there was such excitement about, oh, there's Dr. King. They're so, oh, so excited. And it broke the line, you know, the barrier. And those kids just, they weren't trying to be difficult. It's mm-hmm. just that the pressure broke. And here I was. Now, security picked Dr. King up and put him in the limousine. I was dragged several feet because they ran over me, you know. They didn't mean to. I mean, they weren't trying to harm. But, you know, I had to go to the hospital myself then, you know, to see if I had broken arms and legs. But you just do it. There's no such thing as trying to weigh it all. You got a mission here. There's a cause here. There's an objective. There's a reason why you're out here struggling to right the wrongs, and you do it with pleasure almost.
I want to talk now and shift to what we do similar, which is as a journalist. And I got to tell you, so many people texting and calling. Lisa Ram, who's our colleague here, texted me this morning. She said, you know, I love Janona, but she would be proud of me because she's actually speaking to girls at the Coretta Scott King School today. She's doing a workshop with those kids. So many people, when you're the first of something, that's what we remember. And you're the first to have a news, public affairs show here in the South. I'm just curious what that was like in getting that to air. And did you have people tell you, are you sure, Janona, you want to do this? Are you sure you want to be the first to do this?
No, I didn't think about being first was so special. I welcomed the opportunity because I knew I was going to do well. Because I just pride myself, and I don't go into anything until I prepare myself. So I knew I was on the right track. I was going to do the right thing. And I was hoping that someone would catch the spirit. And they did. I got nice letters from everybody because I was the first, really, in the nation, but we just used the South as our area. The first in the South, and I would get letters from girls who, little girls who said, oh, I want to do that someday. Yeah. And I found out that I was an example. Mm-hmm. But I knew I had to be good because that first is the way I am. Mm-hmm. And then I knew somebody's out there watching, and hopefully they can take my place someday, and that's what has happened. So the thought now, when I look back retrospectively, I said that I made it possible mm-hmm. because I did a good job. I opened the door of opportunity for a lot of people who look like me. Open the door of opportunity.
As I told you earlier before we came out, Robin Smith, who was an anchor reporter in St. Louis, styled her hair after you. I met her when I was in sixth grade. She told me about you. I was so excited. Went home, told my dad, and he pulled out, I think it was an Ebony or Essence.
Yeah.
And he said, I want you to see this. And I read that and I never knew that in my lifetime I would have an opportunity to just say thank you. And I know I'm breaking rank as a journalist here, but I'm probably not here if it's not for someone like you. So mm-hmm. thank you. So I just wanted to say that. Now, was there someone that you wanted to interview or something that you wanted to do that you just couldn't get to them? And who was that person? I can't imagine it's anybody, but maybe.
No, I had a lot of people thrust on me. Like, I ended up with J.B. Stoner, who was the most hatred racist walking or riding. And he was just a mean person.
How did it happen?
Well, I had television. And yeah. I guess in watching me, he said he found I was a nice person. I said, oh, gee, I didn't know he thought I was going to turn flips on the show or what. I didn't know what he thought. But you have to welcome everybody and open the opportunity. But he said, you know, you're not like all the other Negroes. And, you know, then you want to slap him, you know. you know, not to do that, but you really want to. And I said, I think you're trying to say, you know, Negroes, because at the time that's what we were mm-hmm. known as. And I said, but you don't have to be like everybody else to be a nice person. Anybody can be a nice person. Mm-hmm. But we're here to talk about what you're doing. And he was running for public office, and we had to have everybody for mm-hmm. equal opportunity. And but it was hard for me because you really want to slap him because he was so ugly. but when I got through, you know, I escaped his rancor. And he thought I was a nice person. And then he invited me to dinner. I should have gone to see where he goes and what he eats and all that. So I thought maybe he ate nails, but he was okay. Mm-hmm.
You've had several dinners. You were meeting with someone, a representative of the KKK.
Yes.
The night that you heard that you got a phone call. You were at a restaurant, I do believe. Someone came over and said, Ms. Clayton, there's a call. And
yeah.
I'll let you take it from here because that was the night.
Yeah. We were having a dinner, and the maitre d' at the restaurant knew I was here because of the King, so they knew my relationship. And she came over with a little note, said, did you hear about Dr. King? And I had driven him to the airport to go to Memphis, as you have already mentioned. And he called me that afternoon, like 3 o'clock our time. And he said, why does my room number sound so familiar to him? I said, I don't know, because I read in the paper you don't switch hotels, so I don't even know where you are. And he said, well, my room number is 305. And I said, well, that happens to be my address, and you've been in my home so many times, so maybe you just, you know, recognize the familiarity of the room. He said, I finally called my mother, and I had asked him to do his mother ask him, because that Sunday, which was 2 days before this now, because I think it was Tuesday, we had just a wonderful time. We had dinner together. I was at their home, and we had dinner, and then we went to the piano. He said, I bet you didn't know I could sing. I said, well, I heard you could, but I don't know whether you really can or not. And he said, well, get on the piano and give me a B-flat. And so he knew I played the piano, so I gave him a B-flat, and he started singing. I said, oh, it sounds pretty good, you know. And so in the car going to the airport, I talked about his mother calling and said we had so much fun that Sunday afternoon that she wishes that we could have more family moments like that. Mm-hmm. So tell him to change his schedule sometimes and include, you know, family gatherings. So I told him what she said. And as it turned out, I didn't know until later, you know, about when we found he'd been shot. Mrs. King wanted me to go over to their house to see that they were okay. She was concerned about Mom and Dad, mm-hmm. And she was crying. But she said, I will be eternally grateful to you because he called me today. Mm-hmm. And so she said it was about 3 o'clock Atlanta time. And so by that, she thinks, according to the time, mm-hmm. that might have been his last call. Wow. And so she just believed that she got the last call from him because he was shot right after that.
Mm-hmm. After Dr. King was assassinated, what was the conversation about within the inner circle for you all in terms of still getting the movement, still working with the movement, and at the same time, y'all are grieving the loss of your friend? How did you all get through that?
Well, at that time, the Memphis garbage workers strike kind of had taken over the headlines. And so Mrs. King said right away, I'm going to go. So emphasis shifted real quickly just to the garbage strikers. I can't remember what, the march had taken place, but it had been successful. The march on Washington had been very successful to the tune that President Johnson invited all of the civil rights workers to the White House to let them know that nothing happened in the city, the District of Washington, D.C., that in all of its environs, there were no arrests. Nobody tearing down the city. And the president felt like maybe that was a good cause because he had objected to it initially mm-hmm. when they brought him the idea. He and Dr. King had a very good relationship. And Dr. King had told the president about the march, and he tried to advise him not to do it because it's going to just be so turbulent. Mm-hmm. And he was so pleased when nothing happened bad. It was everybody left singing, getting in the buses, going home, and it was a joyful afternoon. Mm-hmm.
We obviously know of Dr. King's legacy and so many others in the movement. But I got to tell you, when a few weeks ago, as that statue was being unveiled, and there you are in front of your statue, and I'm wondering what you're thinking. And then your sister, Jeanetta Cole, who only in the way Jeanetta Cole could do, delivered such wonderful words about you. I know you don't probably worry about your legacy, Mrs. Clayton, but what do you hope you leave for folks here?
You know, you're right. I don't worry about my legacy because I really worry about today. I'm here. I know what I'm doing. I know what is being done to me. I won't know it once I've passed to the great beyond. And there's nothing I can do once I pass over. But I wake up in the morning, every morning, and realize I am she who is up. And I consider it, this is a good day. And I think, what can I do today? I try to measure every day to see that hopefully I'll do something decently for today that will be worthwhile for somebody. Because it's such a good feeling when I help somebody, feed somebody, help to find somebody who's in need. It feels good. And I tell people all the time, who doesn't want to feel good? You know, I do. And so I want to do something to help. I'm just motivated by people's needs, people who want me to help them do something.
You know, I have a collage here of photos. I think we can see it over here. You've been with so many different people, Gordon Parks, Sidney Poitier, but I'm not sure people know of your acting abilities.
Oh, come on. Don't tell you have that.
So for our audience here, yes, we're going to... Now, you know, I tell the story. Late one night, I fell asleep, and I woke up, and this movie was on. And I thought I was dreaming. I said, is that Sonona Clayton? Let's play the trailer for that, can we, Samantha?
You're not going to really do this to me.
Beyond the limits of mortal fear, outside the realm of imagination, there's a place where every nightmare you've ever had comes true. The house on Skull Mountain.
Just wait for it.
The house on Skull Mountain.
That was some screams, Clayton.
I'm the movie star.
That is the best horror movie scream ever.
The paycheck was nice, though.
How did you get to the house on Skull Mountain? How'd that happen?
When a producer comes and offers you a nice check, if you'll come and do something and say something, you do it. But it was an option. I thought, really, I was going to be glamorous, you know, and I thought that they were going to give me some pretty clothes to wear. But let me tell you what crushed my spirits, really. I knew I'd made a mistake when one day we were sitting around, we're ready now to go into action. Mm-hmm. And so the director asked the wardrobe mistress, where are you going to buy Zernona's clothes? Because each star had certain days to get their clothes ready. And so the wardrobe assistant said, oh, I think we're going to go to JCPenney's or Walmart. I was thinking, you know, Neiman Marcus, that's where I wanted to go. I wanted pretty clothes because I thought I was going to wear, you know, gorgeous things. So I looked a mess, but the paycheck was nice.
The paycheck was nice. Have you watched that movie since?
Oh, I tried not to. But I don't know, people still, you know, they used to run it more frequently. I haven't seen it recently, but people call me all the time. I know when it's on because somebody calls me every time it's on TV. And it runs at night mainly, I think.
Mm-hmm. And it's a classic. Ms. Clayton, I have really enjoyed our conversation. I appreciate you taking the time. Wanted to send our best to your husband as well.
Thank you.
If there are any gold nuggets, imparting words you want to leave for younger journalists or just anyone about the price you pay here on Earth, what do you want them to know?
Well, I think I said it on the stone on my statue when it says, if you think you can, you will. That seems to be words that really capture who I am, that if you got a charge in a situation out there in the community, you got homeless people, you got hungry people, And if you really want to feed them, you'll find a way to feed them. If you want to clothe them, you'll find a way to do it. Right now, my next assignment that I've issued to myself is to build a village, 5 houses next to each other, one for a white family, a black family, an Asian family, a Native American family, four, I don't miss one. Because I want to do what Dr. King couldn't do. He said that one of these days I want to see us living together, mm-hmm. loving each other. There's no reason why blacks and whites can't live together. There's just no reason. And he says, and I know for certain we can. We just need to make the effort. Mm-hmm. Because Dr. King says that we all came here the same way, and that's true. The stork delivered us to somebody's address. We all came the same way. And so under the skin, we're really all the same because we all came from the same source. And so before I leave this earth, I want to see us do what Dr. King said. We can live together. So I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to build 4 or 5 houses and make them live next door to each other.
I know you will. Senator Clayton, it's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much for what you've done for humanity, for humankind. Thank you. Senator Clayton.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Ah, yes. And that's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson, Daniel Razel. Our supervising producer is Tiffany Griffith. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderwerf. A reminder to let us know your thoughts on today's program or any others. Send me an email, rose@wabe.org, which I'll love to do, and I'd love to read them. If you missed any of today's show, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And, of course, Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m. as well as in our podcast. So subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.